Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Rodenberg, Judge Larkin, Judge Sleater, the Honorable John R. Rodenberg presiding.
You may be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. As indicated, my name is John Rodenberg. I'm presiding today. With me are Judges Larkin and Sleater. We have four matters on the oral calendar this morning, the first of which is State versus Many. Am I pronouncing the name correctly?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And each of you, as you probably know, will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. When you approach the podium, give us your name and the party you represent so that we've got that for the recording. The podium is adjustable, and feel free to adjust it to suit your comfort. Mr. Kelly, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Kelly, and I represent Alexander Many, the appellant in this case. There are two issues before this court, as briefed by the appellant: sufficiency of the evidence and competency to stand trial, basically whether or not my client had a fair trial. I intend to divide this time equally before the court, but if I've learned anything, it's that sometimes my oral arguments rarely go as planned. With regard to sufficiency of the evidence, I focused the court's analysis on the specific element of the proximate cause of the death of Cameron Johnson and whether or not my client proximately caused that death. Respondent submits in their brief that the jury clearly rejected appellant's argument that the decedent consumed pills that were not provided by my client.
This is the pills that were found by his stepfather later?
These were the, there are two different groups of green pills. There's multiple green pills that were found. What we know from the record is that my client delivered, or my client's girlfriend delivered, four pills to the house. There were more than four pills, similar in appearance, found at the house.
Well, slow down though. There were three and a half found out, correct?
Correct.
And then later, there were some other pills found.
That's correct. In the basement.
Those were never tested, right?
That's correct. But they were similar in appearance, number one. Number two, they were immediately adjacent to the body of the decedent. And perhaps most
important. In a drawer or something?
Yes, right next to the vanity where he was on the floor.
Right.
Can you just elaborate? You say the similar in appearance, meaning the green, the same green pill that there was a picture, as I recall,
right,
taken and shown?
That's right. So they were, as the court is, people take judicial notice that the black market's getting flooded with fentanyl from China. It's highly deadly. People get it from multiple sources. The question is whether or not the fentanyl that was ingested that, according to the medical examiner, caused the death of Mr. Johnson was provided by my client or by some other source. And we don't know that, and we'll never know that.
What we do know, though, is that the cause of death was fentanyl toxicity, correct?
Yes.
You don't argue that?
Correct.
And we do know that the three and a half pills that were found on the counter had fentanyl in them.
Correct.
What we don't know is whether the other green pills had any fentanyl in them.
True.
And you argued that to the jury, right?
I was not trial counsel.
I don't mean you did personally. Appellant did.
The jury heard about the pills that were found by the decedent's stepfather in the vanity right next to the decedent. That's correct.
Okay. So there isn't really any evidence of the existence of fentanyl anywhere other than in the three and a half pills and in the decedent's body, correct?
Only the similarity of the appearance of the pills that we can argue, correct? And the state cannot eliminate this possibility. That's correct. Because this evidence was destroyed immediately upon being discovered by the decedent's stepfather. And this is obviously a point that the defense
Say, Lee, clock didn't start. I'll guess it was two minutes. I don't know. Go ahead, Mr. Kelly.
This was not the fault of the appellant. The investigators were at a death scene. Immediately adjacent to the decedent are these green pills that are never collected and never tested. That can't, the similarity in appearance, the fact that there were two other drugs found in his system, that once again, the medical examiner said that that was not the cause of death, but we know that there were multiple drugs being ingested by this individual. There's bedroom is replete with
Kelly,
different controlled substances.
But the other drugs, wasn't there an explanation that that's consistent with the prescription medication that he was taking?
That's correct. The diazepam, alprazolam, but there was also other street drugs found in his bedroom and in throughout the house. This individual was ingesting a lot of controlled substances other than what was prescribed. But what's shocking from my perspective, and hindsight's always 20/20, is that the investigators never locate paraphernalia that's used to ingest the drugs. Where is the rolled up dollar bill found? According to the record, the rolled up dollar bill was in the vanity next to these other green pills. This person expires in a room filled with green pills, some of which I think it's safe to assume were provided by my client, but which pills caused the death? This is why we cite the McCormick case, because we know in McCormick.
I'm familiar with McCormick.
Which was, I understand, I believe you wrote the opinion.
I did.
Your Honor, okay. And so, you know, this is proximate cause of death that the appellant in McCormick was granted a new trial over, or a reversal of the conviction.
It was a reversal. But of course, the problem we have with putting too much weight on McCormick, and specifically footnote 2 of McCormick, which I did author, is that since then we've had Harris from the Supreme Court, and we're obligated to apply Harris. And it seems to me that Harris requires that we ask whether there's any evidence in the record in our context of any other fentanyl that could be the cause of the death.
Well, and once again, there was no evidence of a second fall in McCormick, and McCormick wasn't reversed.
No, PFR was not granted in McCormick.
Yeah.
But Harris came some years later.
And so we've got, I would analogize the lack of evidence of a second fall in McCormick with the lack of evidence of the fentanyl, the other fentanyl being in the house.
Well, here's the difference, though. In McCormick, there was evidence of a second fall.
And once again, and
there was evidence that was suggestive.
It's suggestive because of the lack of strength of the second deer stand.
Correct.
But I don't recall any testimony about a second fall.
You're correct.
Okay, and so we've got circumstantial evidence. I go back to this issue of, you know, that this is the burden that the state has to establish that there. This is from citing Archambault in McCormick, was citing Archambault, that the burden is not on appellant to prove an alternative explanation for the cause of the death and injuries. Rather, the burden is on the state to prove beyond reasonable doubt that the defendant's acts were the proximate cause of the death of CJ. And so that's what we've got here. They can't eliminate the possibility that this individual who was ingesting drugs, all sorts of different drugs. Keep in mind that the record is clear that when the CJ received these four pills, he told his girlfriend he was going to resell them. He was not going to ingest the pills that my client provided. It's possible he changed his mind, but his stated intent was to resell those pills.
Well, didn't he make some expression, though, of his having, I'm not sure that I remember the details exactly, but didn't he sent text messages suggesting that he had tried these pills and thought them to be good at producing some high?
Yes. So he did indicate...
So that suggests that he consumed some of the pills.
Well, and maybe not, once again, the pills from my client. I think that he was talking about, once again, does he have two sources for these same pills that he's going to now resell? We don't know that. We know there were other green pills present that weren't provided by my client. And the state can never eliminate the possibility that he did not ingest any drugs that my client provided. They cannot eliminate that reasonable possibility. That's what I would submit to this court.
Mr. Kelly, and maybe I wanted to focus on that. You've used that a number of times. This is the first time, though, you qualified it with reasonable. That was going to be my question. And we always tell juries it's not beyond all possibility. There's possible. They don't have to prove any. And maybe I don't want to use the word unreasonable, but the point being is there was no evidence related other than to the fentanyl being the cause of death. And then we have the half of the 3.5 pills, and then we have the picture. Would it be safe to say there's no rational hypothesis that the pills that apparently were in that drawer, number one, had fentanyl? There's no evidence because obviously they're gone. And we know fentanyl caused the death. And so would they not need to show some rational, there would have to be a rational basis for a jury to consider, and there was none.
Well, two points. First off, I think that this court reviews sufficiency of the evidence de novo on appeal. Number two, the jury is never given the law, and they don't have to be given the law by the district court, but they're never given the law of Al-Nassr Silvernail. They don't even know that they have to return a verdict of not guilty if there's a reasonable possibility. They're just told it doesn't mean a fanciful or capricious doubt. It doesn't mean beyond all possibility of doubt. So this court is uniquely positioned, not the jury. This court is uniquely positioned to apply a different standard than the jury was aware that is the law of our land. And that is that this conviction should be reversed if there's a possibility that's reasonable, rational, other than that of guilt. It all comes in this. My argument would come down to: do we really believe that it isn't possible that a person might put all his drugs in a drawer and then pull some out if he's got 6 or 7 total pills? We don't know how much he ingested. We really don't know. And so it's not fair to say that on the top of the vanity are 3.5 or 3 and a little, in the vanity are a couple, plus the rolled up bill, but it's not possible that the drugs that were ingested weren't the 4 that came from my client.
Well, plus a rolled up bill, right?
One rolled up bill.
Right, but we don't have any comparison of what residue, if any, was on that rolled up bill compared to what was in the pills that the decedent got from your client.
And what else would he have ingested the drugs with?
I don't know. It sounds like he had drug paraphernalia around.
Yeah, I understood. But this, once again,
I even have some dollar bills in my pocket.
Yep, yeah, I understand. And I don't know that there was any other paraphernalia for ingestion by snorting found. Just the rolled up bill in the drawer. And so I think it makes sense that was what he used to ingest these drugs.
Given that you can talk more about that if you want to, but you suggested at the outset you wanted to visit about the post-conviction petition, and we actually did start the timer late.
Yes.
So I'll remind you that you've got less than that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll finish up here within 4 minutes, if possible. I was not the trial attorney. This trial strikes me as one of the more unfair, because when I went to see my client, and this is what he testified to at the rehearing, the petition post-conviction relief, he told me, I don't remember this trial at all. And I've never had a defendant who's serving an 86-month commit who has no recollection of his trial. And the reason he had no recollection of his trial was because he was overprescribed Ativan. And we know that he was overprescribed because that was the testimony of uncontroverted testimony of Dr. Gratzer. Dr. Gratzer performs 4 to 5 competency hearings per week. He regularly prescribes Ativan in his practice, and he indicated that dosages should have been at about 0.5 milligram.
Didn't he use the phrase it was at the high end?
High end of the range of potential prescribed amounts, but the high end.
My question is, how do you reconcile that with the factual evidence the court heard that the defense attorney was able to communicate with him? He wrote notes. He seemed to answer questions. He did the things that a trial judge might inconsistent with what raising the concern a judge might have that there might be some impairment.
So I think that my client's behavior, per the record, was off. He was talking louder than he should have been, and so people could hear him. You know, it may have been that he was asking questions. I can tell the courts when I'm doing a trial, I focus on what I'm doing. I don't really spend a whole lot of time on what my client's doing. But he's moving his chair, hitting his leg. There was some behavior. But the record that justifies the reversal and a retrial is not with regard to my client's out-and-out behavior. It's with regard to the exhibits that have been made part of this record where the practitioners, three practitioners involved here, say that this should not have happened, basically. Number one, the titration has to happen when you go back on the Ativan. And his doctor, Peterson, prescribed the same levels that he had 50 days prior he'd been without the drug. So when you talk about the higher levels, you're talking about up to 6 milligrams a day for a person who is completely psychotic and you want to turn them into, and aggressive, and you want to turn them into a mental puddle. So you just melt them down with up to 6 milligrams a day. My client was at 4. Why should somebody be going to trial at 4? And the nurse in the jail warned, and Peterson warned the court, this can cause sedation, memory loss. This is not, especially according to the nurse at the jail, especially not at 4 milligrams a day.
There were conversations about this before the trial, before he started taking the Ativan and then attended the trial, right?
Correct.
Because he wanted to get out so he could take the Ativan.
That's correct.
Seems like in that context, the district court judge would have been particularly attentive to what's going on with this guy who wanted to get out so he could take the Ativan.
And this, I mean, I did my, just so you know, I did my first research when he told me about what had happened to him on the internet. It comes up in 3 seconds. This can cause sedation. This can cause memory loss, amnesia. This is to be, you know, titration. All of this stuff is general knowledge.
Well, so the point Dr. of my Gratzer, question, though, is not whether that can happen. The point of my question is, ought we not to defer to the district judge who would have been attentive to this and decided that he seemed like he was okay and he didn't buy it?
Yeah, so I don't think that a person's inability to remember, a person's amnesia, a person's sedation is something that's going to jump out at you. They're going to appear the way my client's family described him, quiet, kind of sedated. Paige Minnie testified to this. This was, once again, not controverted by other testimony, that he was, in fact, not himself. The warning signs were there for the district court. The warning signs were there that 4 milligrams a day was way too much, and should not be prescribed. This was not something that happened where I'm not coming before you with a client who says, well, I was at trial, but I was at home getting high every day before I went to trial, and I just don't remember what happened in the trial because I was ingesting street drugs. This happened in plain sight, and the evidence before the court indicates that this amounted to a lack of a fair trial. Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you.
State, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is David Hemming. I'm here with co-counsel Amy Capelli. Counsel, we represent the respondent in this case, the state of Minnesota. Your Honor, I wanted to just jump to a couple of specific questions that you had regarding the pills in this instance. Your Honor, what the district court, what the evidence showed presented to the district court in regards to those specific pills is there is a long lead up in text messages in which the appellant provided a discussion of providing these specific pills to the victim. Long discussion of that. That was presented at trial. There was admissions from the co-defendant that all occurred. But getting right to the nitty-gritty of the pills in the vanity in the bathroom where the victim died. When the family and ultimately law enforcement responded to that specific bathroom, what they found on the vanity counter was 3.5 green pills and a knife and crushed up pills consistent with a person who would have cut a pill, crushed it, and snorted it. That's what was found on the top of the bathroom vanity when the family and law enforcement arrived. Those pills were tested. Those pills came back as furanyl fentanyl. The cause of death from the medical examiner determined that the victim died of furanyl fentanyl. And there was a question, one of your honors asked about how do we know these are the pills? Well, Your Honor, we know these are the pills, Your Honors, we know these are the pills because after the victim got the pills, he texted a picture of the 4 green pills to his brother-in-law, and then he also sent a video Snapchat message to his best friend about these pills. And then after he ingested the pills, Your Honor, page 8 of the state's brief or respondent's brief outlines the specific message that he sent to his best friend. And in that message, he said, "I just snorted a tiny line. I'm effed up, dude. You're going to be mind blown." So if there was a question.
Reference to the pills that he had obtained from the appellant and his girlfriend.
Correct, Your Honor. And that is consistent with the idea that he just got these pills. And the timeline of these text messages is important, that he got those pills from appellant, that he went to his bathroom, that he cut one up, that he crushed it, and then he snorted it. He said, he tells specifically how much he said, "I had a tiny line," and then he's found deceased a short time later. So, Your Honor, putting that evidence together suggests the complete insufficient evidence claim, the analyze the record to determine whether the evidence, when viewed in most light favorable to the victim, was sufficient to permit the fact finder to reach the verdict that they did. And the idea that these alternate pills were the proximate cause of the victim's death. Appellant's trial counsel, that was their entire theory of the case. They argued that theory from their opening statement through the course of the trial, through their closing statement, all the way through. The theory was to the jury that it wasn't the pills on the vanity that caused the death of Cameron Johnson. The pills later found in the bathroom vanity drawer were the cause of death for that victim. So that idea was thoroughly vetted by the jury, Your Honor.
Of course, as counsel points out, he's not completely wrong. The jury didn't really, after Harris and the other cases, didn't really have the instruction that would direct them to do the thing that we are now obligated to do.
I agree with that, Your Honor. The jury instruction on direct and circumstantial evidence indicates that they should be given equal weight. That's the instruction that is provided, and there's never been any alternative suggestion from appellate courts that that's not appropriate. Of course, we're here, and
there's been some suggestion from some on appellate courts that there should be a different instruction, but that hasn't been accepted by our Supreme Court.
Correct, Your Honor.
In a case like this, why doesn't the state want that instruction? Have prosecutors given any thought to that? It seems to me if the jury had gotten that instruction, that is basically the Al-Nusseir instruction, like we used to back in the old days, then the jury returns a verdict of guilty if they do, and we're not even having this discussion because they were fully instructed, they arrived at a verdict. Verdict is supported by the evidence. We're done.
I'll say this, Your Honor, and this is just my own personal opinion on this. The Al-Nusseir analysis in which you have to go through on the appellate level is not very simple. Jury instructions are meant to be very simple. You're taking people without a legal background, instructing them on the law so they can go forward. I believe it would be very challenging to come up with a jury instruction that would outline the Al-Nasir decision and all that kind of circumstantial evidence review in a way that a juror would understand. I think jury instructions in themselves are sometimes confusing. I think trying to do that would create more confusion. So on that specific point, Your Honor, the respondent would suggest that the jury had the sufficient information. There is a wealth of evidence that was presented on which specific pills the victim consumed, and the jury did not believe the evidence of these alternative pills. And as one of Your Honors suggested, those pills were never tested. We don't even know what they were. The defense, the trial, appellant's trial counsel submitted a picture to the jury, and they are similar in appearance and similar in color, but past that, we don't have any information of what they actually were.
Do we, was there testimony in the record on not those pills now, the other ones that were found later and thrown away? These four pills, I take it these were manufactured black market pills and they were not from any pharmaceutical company?
Correct, Your Honor. There was evidence in the record that suggested that perhaps even appellant, but more importantly, the victim in this case believed that the pills he was consuming were oxycodone. They were stamped with
as Oxy-80s, right?
Correct. So I believe the victim thought that he was consuming oxycodone. He did not believe that he was consuming fentanyl, or that's what we can deduce from the information presented at the trial.
Were the ones that were thrown away, now that gets us to my actual question, were the ones that were thrown away pills that were stamped with 80 on them?
Your Honor, my recollection of those is they were not complete pills. They were almost shards or half pills.
I looked at a photo and I do think they were broken up, and it wasn't the greatest picture in the world, but...
Correct. And the reason why those were never tested, Your Honor, is the stepfather found these pills later. His stepson had just died from consuming.
How much
those.
Later were they found, by the way?
I believe 2 weeks, Your Honor. But his stepson had died. He had found his stepson, and he had been told by the police these are dangerous, and clearly they were. So he immediately took a picture, flushed them just to get them out of the house, which seems like a very reasonable thing for a parent to do. Your Honor, I'll turn to the second issue before the court, and this is the competency. And what respondent would suggest in this case, Your Honor, is there is absolutely zero evidence in the record that would suggest that appellant in this case was incompetent. The only evidence is appellant's own statement, his own self-serving statement that at the time of his trial that he was incompetent. And what's important about that is he never raised that with his trial counsel. He never raised that with any of his family members at the time of the trial. It was only after he'd been convicted and was sitting in jail and waiting sentencing did this come to light that, oh my gosh, I don't remember the trial. The district court in this case, Your Honors, that was the trial judge was also the post-conviction judge. And as Your Honors alluded to, the district court, when this came up, this idea of getting released from custody to take this Ativan, it's cited in the district court's order, made a specific inquiry with the appellant about the side effects or possible side effects. That was all forewarned in a sense, and the district judge went through that with the appellant himself and the attorney. And appellant said, "Nope, no issues. I've taken this before. I'm not going to have any problems." So there was ample evidence that the district court reviewed for the post-conviction hearing. First of all, his trial attorney, from respondent's perspective, would be in the best position to know the status of the client throughout the course of the trial. His trial attorney was named Kevin DeVore.
That's the same trial attorney who assisted him in making the motion to get out so that he could take the Ativan.
That's correct, Your Honor. His trial attorney testified at the post-conviction hearing, basically indicated that they had consulted throughout the course of the trial, that his client had a notebook, and he had been writing down relevant questions and been asking him relevant questions throughout the course of the trial, that he had been reacting to certain witnesses' testimony in the sense that he heard what a witness would say and reacted appropriately to what that particular witness would say. They spoke on breaks, and on a real important issue, and a constitutional issue in a trial, the right to remain silent, Mr. DeVore testified that they talked on that on many occasions, and before he ultimately went in the record and indicated that he wished to remain silent and not testify, they discussed that. They had a good discussion, and then the record reflects the soliloquy between the district court and appellant that he was waiving that right. Appellant was awake during the trial. He was conscious during the trial. Mr. DeVore even indicated that he had a past circumstance with a client that he believed that client was incompetent after consuming drugs. And he actually informed the district court in that separate trial. And he indicated in this case, if I had any concerns of my client's incompetence or not paying attention, I would have informed the district court right away. And he never informed the district court. A few more things on that specific point. Counsel mentioned Paige Menny, his cousin, that referenced dealing with him throughout the course of the trial. What she said, though, was that appellant told her, I remember you at my trial, but I don't recall her mom, my aunt, at the trial. If he recalls seeing his cousin at the trial, that would suggest that he has memory of the trial itself.
Mr. Hemming, isn't it true the doctor, you say there's no evidence, though the doctor seemed, although it was hypothetical as I understand it, opined that this was on high level and that he would not have recommended it in the similar hypothetical situation. And in fact, I think the opinion he had was his opinion would be impaired by having that much.
That, Your Honor, that is correct. The doctor, Dr. Gratzer, I think his name was, did in fact testify, but I think whatever he says has to be somewhat taken in context in the sense that he never met the appellant. He never reviewed the medical records of appellant. He didn't know anything about the appellant. So he was, as you indicated, speaking in hypotheticals. He had no information on the tolerance or lack of tolerance for the appellant. He had no information. So he came in and he told the district court about, well, here's what Ativan does, and here's some of the side effects, and here are what the dosages and things like that. But that information, frankly, isn't relevant because you can't put it into context of how it would impact a specific person. There was no information how what he said you could tie to a specific person, or specifically to the appellant, simply because he had never met him, he had never reviewed any of his medical records. I think maybe he had read that note from his family physician, but past that, he didn't know anything else. Another thing on the point, the second day of trial, after the appellant had been consuming this Ativan, he had been out of jail, so he was on a supervised release with a probation officer. That probation officer, Amy Chavez, testified at the post-conviction hearing, and she said that on that second day of trial, he came up to her at the end of the day and said, I'm sorry for being rude or disrespectful the day before. Again, indicating that he has knowledge, he's making a conscious memory of what he did the day before, also suggesting that he was awake, conscious, and has a clear memory of the trial. And lastly on that point, Your Honor, the district court who allowed him to be released from custody, and I think there was a statement, well, wouldn't this judge have been particularly attentive to the issues for appellant? Of course. She let him out of jail to take these drugs, to take this Ativan. And what that same district court did in her order was say that there's no information to suggest that he was incompetent. Being loud and shifting in your chair, come on. That happens all the time. It happens when a person's nervous. It happens when a person's not nervous. It's just a tick that someone might have. There is no demonstrated evidence on that point. And finally, Your Honors, it's a point made by the district court in the final page of her order. Even if we would believe him to say that he couldn't remember the trial, there was no evidence actually offered at the post-conviction hearing to suggest that he was unable to understand the proceedings, that he was unable to consult with his attorney, or unable to participate in his defense. My time has expired, and I will be seated. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kelly, do you wish to use your time for rebuttal?
Briefly. I'll reference the court to the testimony of with regard to when the pills were discovered. That can be found in the trial transcript on page 422.
This is the second set of pills.
The second set of pills.
Thank you.
That was a testimony of Jason Bjork that the dollar bill and the pills were found in the vanity approximately 2 weeks after the death of Cameron Johnson, consistent with counsel's recollection of the record. That's on page 422. The testimony of Dr. Gratzer was, once again, uncontroverted, that the lack of titration and the lack of an observation of the appellant upon resumption of the Ativan was the salient problem that gave him concern. These levels need to be approached gradually, and they need the changes in the ability of the patient to benefit from versus be basically limited by the medication must be observed, and none of this was done by Dr. Peterson.
Well, I don't get the impression from the post-conviction order that the district court denied the petition for post-conviction relief because the district court found that there was nothing wrong with the way the doctor had prescribed it. It seems like the relevant part of that denial of the post-conviction petition comes on pages 18 and 19, where the district court says, at no point during the trial was the court given reason to, during the trial, that she was right on the scene and watching this, was the court given reason to doubt petitioner's competency. Petitioner demonstrated competency during the trial to the judge who ends up denying the post-conviction petition, never displayed any signs of not understanding. The court was aware of the possible side effects of Ativan and discussed those side effects with petitioner, and then finally concludes with his testimony at the post-conviction petition lacks credibility. Isn't our standard of review deferential to the credibility findings of the district court?
Yes, but it's not absolute, number one. Number two, I'm not sure how else an appellant who's been overprescribed Ativan would prove his mental state and his inability to recall, other than to call a respected professional who would testify that the manner in which it was prescribed was a mistake, and then to testify under oath that he has no recollection. I'll tell the court that some of the specific examples that are in the record at that motion for rehearing, for retrial. My client was at trial, there was testimony that a computer that was collected that belonged to his girlfriend was attributed to him. And my client testified at that hearing that when he read the transcript, it was like reading a transcript to a movie he'd never seen. He has no recollection of what happened, but he notices, wait a second, they introduced my girlfriend's computer and the jury was told it was mine. And then the information in the computer was attributed to me. And if I'd have known what was going on, I'd have said, wait, that's not my computer. But he never even wrote that down for the attorney. So when you don't testify, when all you say is good morning, and yes, Your Honor, and no, Your Honor, and sometimes he didn't quite get that right, how do you really know how incompetent a person is? You're not even having a conversation with the defendant. You're watching him sit there. And so I don't know that the district court had a lot to go on other than addendum 2 to my brief and addendum 3 to my brief. This is from the jail nurse. Literature recommends that benzodiazepines are not indicated due to an increased risk of abuse and certainly not prescribing up to 4 milligrams a day as needed. Addendum 3 was the letter of Dr. Peterson, and she indicates that the medication caused side effects, including sedation, lethargy, dizziness, and see enclosed adverse reaction list for a complete side effect profile. So the court had the signals in front of it, and it's uncontroverted that you can't just jump back onto 2 milligrams twice a day and expect to be at your best, certainly, but even more than that, competent to stand trial. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We will, of course, issue our decision within 90 days. We thank counsel for your briefing and arguments.
See, Mark.
Okay, good.